Please be advised, all music tracks used in this production are sole property of Kelsun Communications and are original compositions. Thank you.
We'll be right back after this message from our sponsor.
Hello, travelers. We'd like to introduce you to Hoppin' Bus Service, LLC, founded in 2018. Our goal is to provide people across the U.S. with world-class travel and tourism services. Our expertise allows us to offer our customers the best deals. We've built a reputation on tailoring our services to meet your needs. We specialize in motor coach buses and party buses. We offer clean vehicles and professional drivers for your next trip or occasion. Our passion is safe traveling. We're a contract carrier licensed to operate in all 48 states. We believe in providing a personal touch beyond just making your next charter bus or party bus reservation. You can book us today for your next amusement park, casino, or family reunion trip. We can handle all of your transportation needs like corporate events, weddings, or proms. We're committed to making travel easy for you. For a free quote today, call 833-774-6746. That's 833-774-6746. And remember, don't just stand there, hop in.
Hey, it's Skiri Jones, executive producer of Elvis Duran and the Morning Show on Z100. I want to talk to you all about my friend and fellow Brooklyn College alumnus, Silas. Your e-journalist, social work advocate, Silas hosts and produces the award-winning Kelsun on the Air social work podcast. My friend and fellow BCR alum is now known nationally and internationally as Silas, your e-journalist, social work advocate. His podcast, it's also listed as one of the top social work podcasts you must follow, the award-winning Kelsun on the Air social work podcast.
Hello and welcome to all our listeners and viewers. This is Silas, your e-journalism social work advocate, producer and host of the award-winning Kelsun on the Air social work podcast, available wherever you get your podcast. Our podcast is rated internationally as one of the 40 best social work podcasts you must follow. This podcast promotes, celebrates, uplifts, and highlights the social work profession. Our aim is to educate the general public about the powerful impact social workers have on the lives of those they serve. The podcast will also amplify the vital contributions professional social workers make in every aspect of our society every day.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. This is Silas, your e-journalism social work advocate, host of the award-winning Kelsun on the Air social work podcast. And I'm really excited today to be able to introduce my special guest we have with us today, Dr. Anthony E. Street. He is the Chief Executive Officer of the National Association of Social Workers. We're going to tell you a little bit about him, but it's really, really a thrill and an honor. Dr. E. Street, thank you so much for joining us. And I'm going to let the folks know a little bit about you before we have our conversation. So welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Thank you. Dr. Anthony E. Street is currently the CEO of the National Association of Social Workers, NASW, and is a highly esteemed leader in the field of social work. Dr. E. Street, who has more than two decades of experience in the social work profession, has made significant contributions to the field through his academic and professional endeavors. Dr. E. Street began his career as an adjunct professor at Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland, and later became the MSW program's chair and full professor. While at Morgan State, he co-edited a groundbreaking book on African-centered clinical interventions and social work mental health practice. He published over 40 peer-reviewed journal articles on social work education, workforce development, and social work practice. In addition to his academic work, Dr. E. Street has held several leadership positions within the social work profession. He served as vice president of the NASW board of directors and as chair of the NASW alcohol, tobacco, and other drug specialty practice sessions and the National Ethics Committee. In addition, he co-chaired a committee tasked with planning and executing an innovative national social work conference. Dr. E. Street has served as a clinical director, the chief executive officer of a treatment facility, and a senior executive consultant. He is the founding president of the National Association of Black Social Workers, Baltimore Legacy Chapter. Dr. E. Street's dedication to serving vulnerable populations and his enthusiasm for the social work profession has made him an ideal candidate to lead NASW. His extensive knowledge and expertise is invaluable as he advances the organization's goals in improving the lives of those who rely on social workers for advocacy and support. Dr. Eastreet earned a bachelor's in science and psychology from Bowie State University, an MSW at Virginia Commonwealth University, a doctorate in social work at Morgan State University, and an MBA at the University of Maryland, College Park. He is a member of the Alpha Phi Alpha, the oldest intercollegiate African-American fraternity. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct pleasure to present to some and introduce to others our distinguished guest for today, CEO of the NASW National Chapter, Dr. Anthony Eastreet. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Silas. I'm so excited to be here. As you know, I just finished my first year in this role. So we are a year and almost 2 months into this role, and it has been such an exciting time. There's a lot of exciting things going on in social work right now, and I'm just super excited to be here and share some of those things with you and just talk about all things social work.
Absolutely, absolutely. We're really looking forward to having this conversation. So as we get ready to get things started, just tell our listeners and viewers and our audience a little about your background.
Yeah, so I am what people would call a military brat. And so I grew up, my dad was in the military, and we grew up kind of all over the place. So it's always interesting when somebody says, oh, where are you from? And I'm like, I'm kind of from all over. We spent summers, lots of our summers were in North Carolina. So my mom is from North Carolina. My dad is originally from Baltimore. But I had the distinct pleasure of being able to travel the world at a young age, meet new friends. And some people were like, oh, how did you do that? What was that like? But I think one of the things that you learn at a young age, especially being in a military family, is that you adapt, right? And that, the greatest thing that happened, as a result of that was you made a lot of friends. And then Facebook came where you got the chance to reconnect with all those friends. And so that was such a beautiful moment, being able to connect with friends that you haven't seen for so long. And it's just like any other friendship. There's a pause button where, you haven't seen each other for quite some time, but the moment that y'all link up again, it's as if time stood still. You're back in the fold talking about all things. And so, I'm a father, I have a dog, I am a normal everyday person that loves to talk about social work, but really, outside of social work, I like to binge watch all types of movies on Netflix and just kind of relax.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. So now I want you to share with our audience, what made you choose a career in social?
That is an interesting story. So as you mentioned in my bio, I graduated from Bowie State University in 2005. During that time when I was at Bowie, I was actually a psychology major. So in my mind, I was like, you know what? I'm going to go through and be a psychologist and do the whole psychology thing. I was really fascinated with mental health. And at that time, that was all that I had known. And then at that same time, as I was showing an interest in Alpha Phi Alpha, I met a social worker. His name was Mike Green, still great friends to this day. And I still consider him one of my biggest mentors, who started talking to me about social work as a career and really, sat down and explained the profession to me and all the things that you could do. And that was the first time for me that I knew that there was another path to addressing mental health that allowed for a lot more versatility. But also one of the more important things to me was to be able to understand the person and environment. So talking to Mike really talked about how we look at people in their environment and try to help them to thrive within their environment and not necessarily the environment that we would want them to be in, right? And so I think for me, that was kind of that defining moment for me when I immediately graduated from my bachelor's program and applied to graduate school. And that's how I ended up getting my MSW from Virginia Commonwealth University.
Okay, all right. Now, I'm sure audience members would like to know, and I'm going to ask you to share with us the direction that you see social work heading as you sit here on our show today.
So, I get so excited talking about this, right? Because, social work right now is at what I would call an inflection point. And we have a lot of different things that we have to work through within our own profession. But I also fundamentally believe that if we do this correctly, we can come out on the other side stronger, more connected, a more open and honest profession to really reflect the values that we believe in. And what I mean by that is, you know, we're talking a lot about different things in terms of the compact, in terms of the examination, in terms of the removal of DE&I, in terms of advocacy, in terms of higher social work salaries. I think all of these things are on the table, and I think that we are well equipped to be able to address many of these challenges within our own profession. And so for me, when I think about the direction of social work, I think about us coming together more as a profession. So all of the different social work organizations coming together to really advocate and to collaborate to make the social work profession better. One of the things that I have been saying a whole lot as we're talking about empowering social workers is really just the idea of if people take care of their social worker in terms of a good salary, in terms of safe working conditions, in terms of being able to have a good work-life balance, that social worker will indeed take care of all the things that are required of that social worker to take care of. So that means, you know, doing all the things that are required for families, children's, communities, organizations. If you employ a social worker and you are definitely taking care of that social worker will in turn take care of the things that you need for your organization and or the community. But more than that, I think that this whole conversation around where is social work heading, it does really speak to the idea of workforce. And Silas and I were having a beautiful conversation before this where we were just talking about just the idea of social work. And one of the things that I think that we have to work on as a profession is our overall branding, right? And so when we talk about branding, when we talk about the profession, we oftentimes see us depicted in the media and in movies as ran down, tired, not making money, high caseloads. And while that may be the experience of some, that is not the experience of all social workers. And what we need to do is really start to take control of that narrative, right? And so when you're at your position, when we're talking about the direction of social work, especially around branding, we're talking about people being proud social workers, letting people know what social workers do, no matter what sector you're in, whether it's film, journalism, technology, finance, consulting, entrepreneurship. If you are a social worker and you're out here doing the work that you want to do and that brings you that passion, be proud about that and identify yourself as a social worker so that we can start to change that narrative and start to create some branding around what social workers do.
Yes, yes, I agree 100%. Now, you mentioned something very, very important, and I'm sure a lot of our audience members would like to know more about it. You mentioned about the social work compact. Can you explain to our viewers, listeners, and audience what that's all about?
Yes, yes, yes. The social work compact is a movement that I am really, really proud of and looking forward to. It is basically the way that social workers will be able to practice across state lines with their current license. And so if, you know, the compact in itself is basically in last year, in March of 2023, we passed the compact language, or we helped to get the compact language passed. And so what that does is it creates a framework for each state to go to their legislator and then pass this model legislation that says that if you are licensed in state A, and then that state is part of the compact, and then state B is part of the compact, then we'll accept that license in both states with no additional requirements. And so what this does is it streamlines this process of reciprocity, which I know people have heard about reciprocity and all the different ins and outs of reciprocity, depending on the state that you're going, that you're getting licensed in. But the reality situation is this will help to create more access in our workforce, but also more access for individuals in different communities, whether it be rural, whether it be different states, to have access to a wider range of social workers, right? And so the compact in itself is moving right along. So as of last week, we had four states that were signed onto the compact. Missouri was the first state, and now we have three more signed on, and we have about 27 states with compact legislation currently moving through various stages of that legislature. The beautiful thing about it is that in order to stand up the compact commission, we need about 7 to 10 states that have passed that compact bill. And once we get those 7 to 10 states, then we can start to create the compact commission, which will create the rules around what each state is going to do in terms of honoring and how the compact is going to work. After that, they will create the compact application, and then we're off to the races. I think one of the things to, as we're talking about the compact, I do also like to set expectations in terms of what this is going to look like. Because, you know, I see a lot of people on social media is like, we should have been had this. Why is this not moving faster? Yes, we should have had this, right? At the same time, the compact bill has to be passed by each state. So it's not a national thing that can happen. It has to be passed by each state and accepted by each state. And so as you can imagine, each state legislator has different schedules, different times they meet, different priorities. And so as they're coming along, we will be tracking that. The other part of it too is the nursing profession has had the oldest compact out there. And so currently they have about 40 or 41 states. And so that kind of gives you the scope that not every state is going to sign on to the compact. There are some states that are just not compact friendly, and we understand that. But for the large majority of the workforce, being a part of the compact and having a compact for social workers allows for greater license portability. Now, there is a caveat that I just want to be transparent about. And this is not specific to social work. This is part of every single compact out there. One of the things about the compact is that you will have to pass a national qualifying examination. And so that in and of itself has created some tension within the social work profession around the pass rates of the examination. And so we're also working on what are some things, what are some solutions that can happen in that space. So with that, I want to say the compact is moving right along, and it will require the passing of a national qualifying examination to be a part of that compact.
And that point about the exam. So one of the things that's been a really hot topic recently, a lot of organizational movement about the substantial performance disparities between candidates of different racial and ethnic groups taking the ASWB. And let's just talk about right now, the master's level exam. What is NASW's opinion on that? Because it has been shown, the statistics show that the test as currently constructed or as has been constructed was not an equitable exam.
Yeah, and so, you know, as you can imagine, that has been a very hot topic. And, you know, NASW continues to advocate for change within those levels. And we're advocating for change in two different ways, right? Understanding that at the end of the day, licensing for social workers is a top priority, right? So licensing in our profession is how we identify within the profession. But at the same time, there's been this kind of weird mincing of words that NASW is trying to do away with licensing. And that's far from the truth. What we are looking at is different options for the examination. And so what that means is that NASW has looked at and talked to various states, right? And we are comfortable saying that, you know, elimination of the examination at that bachelor's and that generalist level examination would be fine, because we're also relying on accredited schools of social works that are granting degrees to be able to establish a certain level of competency via degree graduation. Now, at that bachelor's level and that generalist level, in most cases, you're going to have additional supervision. You're going to have like a provisional license, and somebody's going to be monitoring and watching the work that you're doing. So the examination in and of itself does not add a different level of licensure for those that have the examination versus those that do not. And so if you look at the current structure of it, there are about 9 or 10 states that don't even require the generalist examination, and even more that don't require the bachelor's examination. So not all states are created equal when it comes to this generalist examination. Now, when we get to that clinical license, all 50 states require that clinical license, and we have not made any statements around what that's going to look like yet. But we do have a pilot going on. We're not really a pilot, but there was an option created in Illinois at that clinical examination. And what that option does is if a person has taken the examination at that clinical license one time and failed, then they now become eligible for an option of having additional supervision of 3,000 hours, and then they become eligible for that clinical examination. That just went into effect in January of 2024 in Illinois. Now, when it comes to this whole idea of the examination, language has power, right? And so we started off saying, you know, alternatives to examination, alternative to licensure. But then as we started having more conversations with the profession, you know, we started to understand that it's not always an either or kind of situation. It's going to be a both and, because there's always going to be a core group of social workers that want to pass the examination, that will continue to try to pass the examination, because that is the standard that we set. At the same time, we are not oblivious to the idea of creating options for social workers that have had some challenges with passing the examination. And options is a very broad term. It could look like additional study time. It could look like additional options for examination. And the thing that I think is really important, especially as we're talking about licensure as a whole, is that the examination is one step in a licensure process. And so most licensure process, and I can speak for Maryland, you have to have a background check, you have to fill out an application, you have to pay dues, you have to have your supervisor, you have to have a board approved supervisor sign off on that they will agree to supervise you. So there's different steps that happen in that licensure process that also go to protect the public, right? And so one of the arguments that people say all the time is that, oh, the examination is how we are protecting the public. And, you know, the argument to that is that how does an examination protect the public? It creates this idea that you're measuring competency, but at the same time, you can go to any social work board's website and find people that are licensed that have acted inappropriately or have been sanctioned by boards. And so the licensing process is what or the license itself is what protects the public, because it gives the board a way to sanction social workers that are acting inappropriately or behaving inappropriately. It is not the examination. The license itself protects the public and not the examination. And so when we think about different options for the examination, we are open to having conversations. And so in that, we have also been meeting regularly with CSWE and ASWB and having these conversations, because again, and I said this earlier when we were talking about where do I see the direction of the social work profession going, it really does create an opportunity for us as social workers and social work organizations to really address a problem within our own profession and correct it within our own means. Because I do think the solution to all these challenges that we have within our profession can be solved by our profession. We don't need outside people coming in telling social workers what to do. And so in that, we've always kept an open door and an open conversation with all the major social work organizations to try to address this. So I don't want anybody to think that we aren't looking for solutions to having options, but also looking for solutions to addressing the examination. Because at the same time, the easiest solution for us would be to address the examination and to correct the wrong that has happened from that, and so that we can keep this kind of standard. At the same time, we also have to think about workforce and providing access to individuals that have been harmed previously by not being able to pass the examination.
And then the other thing is that we have had several conversations about, well, if the examination has been deemed to be flawed, and then we're saying, okay, we're going to just do away with the exam and you're going to get a license via graduating. Some people see that as letting ASWB off the hook, because they're the ones that designed the exam. So, what could be said about that? Instead of holding them to the task of saying, make an equitable exam, because we don't feel that the people are not passing because they lack the intelligence. We feel that people are not passing because the exam was skewed in a way that it wasn't meant for those who have failed on numerous times to pass. So what can be said about that?
No, I agree, right? And so, I don't want for one second, because, when the data first came out, I'm not even going to lie about this. There was a huge emotional response to that data being released. I was faculty, a professor at Morgan State University, and this was a challenge that we had experience a lot from our students, right? And our students saying and talking about their experiences with taking the exam multiple times, not being able to pass it. And so I fundamentally want us to be careful about how we shape this narrative, right? And because I don't want it to become a situation where people are saying Black and brown people, old people, people that speak English as a second language are not able to pass an examination, because that's just fundamentally false. I'm certainly able to pass the examination, and I passed it on the first time. At that same time, that does not necessarily change the experience of other people in terms of how they take the exam, what's going on with them when they take the exam, or that we need to shift the exam or change the examination in and of itself. And so that is why, you know, it is fundamentally important for NASW, CSWE, ASWB, and all the different social work organizations to come together to one, have these critical dialogues around what are some of those root causes to the examination having biases, but also what are or how are students and other people showing up in the room when taking the examination, right? And I think both of those things can be true at the same time, and that we have to address both of them, right? So it's not just letting ASWB off the hook, because we're still asking ASWB to change the examination. At that same time, we also have to make sure that we're doing what we need to do in schools of social work, but also as individuals to be able to pass the examination, right? And so, you know, there's a lot of resources out there to help people pass the examination. And I hope that, you know, we're also looking at those, because there's a lot of people that also claim to have strong programs in helping people pass the examination. But when you ask them for their data about, hey, how many social workers have you actually gotten to pass the examination, or have you helped pass the examination? Some of those people don't have the data to back up what their claims are, right? And so I think fundamentally it is both holding ASWB accountable, but also understanding that there's different elements to passing an examination that we also have to address at the individual level, right? And so, you know, one of the things that I heard is, oh, such and such is just a bad test taker. Now, what does that mean? Because that can mean a lot of different things. Like if we're talking about, oh, such and such has anxiety when they take exams, or such and such has ADHD and they're having a hard time focus, or such and such, you know, can't sit down and take a four hour examination. I think those are all things that can also be true and that we have to address, right? And so I think that it's a mix of figuring out what are these different options and how can we better serve the workforce, and making sure that people that are coming in are able to obtain the license that they work so hard in school to get, right? And so the other part of that too is really thinking about, you know, as we're addressing this, is really, I think one of the fundamental things, and I had a conversation with another social worker about this the other day, prior to maybe 2016, I had no understanding of how the examination process went or who wrote the examination. And so, you know, for me, it's also a challenge to get more people of color, more people that speak English as a second language, more people involved in the test writing process, right? I mean, test question writing process, because if we start to really think about who's writing the examination, how we're getting that information, how are we getting those experiences, we would then start to see that the way that people see social work and practice social work, depending on where you're from and your experiences, is going to vary. And so we also have to make sure that we're getting various degrees of people writing questions for those examinations, while also making sure that we're shifting examination to eliminate bias.
Okay. Thank you for that insight and that input. Now, as far as the exam goes, when you mentioned the Interstate Licensure Compact, you said eventually when it all gets sorted out that there will be a national qualifying exam.
Yep.
So would that in any way be the standard requirement, or is that only for people who are planning on maybe practicing in another state?
So it depends, right? And that is one of the things that I try to be transparent about. If you are interested in practicing and being a part of the Interstate Compact, you will have to pass a national qualifying examination. Right now, that is the ASWB examination. But at the same time, the compact language is very broad to say that if somebody else came up and developed a national qualifying examination, that could also meet the bar, right? And so it's not It's not codifying ASWB in the examination because it's leaving it open for different options for the examination. I think the other thing too is that the options aspect of it really does allow for workplace advancements based on states, right? And so I'll give you an example. Illinois, again, removed the examination requirement at that bachelor's and generalist level, and they saw an increase of 3,000 social workers entering the workforce. At that same time, at the top of this year, they just hit a milestone of having more than 10,000 licensed social workers in the state of Illinois that are ready and trained to work with various communities and organizations around that state. Now, is that going to be the same case for every state? Probably not. But the reality of the situation is most people that I have come across and most people that I know want to practice social work in their communities. I've been licensed since 2007. I live in Maryland, right? So in Maryland, there's at least five different states that touch and they're within driving distance that I could practice in, right? I've never once had the urge to get licensed through reciprocity at any of those other states because there's more than enough work for me to do here in my community, here in the DMV Baltimore area. And really, most of the people that I've talked to, they just want to work in their communities. They want to do good work. They want to have access and be able to do the things that they went to school for, right? And so as we're thinking about access and enhancing the workforce, I think those are very nuanced conversations. There's going to be a core group of people that do want to utilize the compact. And so when you think about it, right, the compact came about because of the Department of Defense and how people in the military moved about, right? So to be able to practice and work in different areas, especially as your family is being transferred all over through the military, it makes for licensure portability easy. We also saw a lot of that come from COVID, right? With traveling social workers. We saw the need for social workers to be at the ready to deal with various crises, right? And so when we think about what this means for social workers and the ability to do the work that we can at a moment's notice without having to go through that long reciprocity process that can be anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 months, there is a place for the compact. And there's going to be a core group of people that are going to engage in that compact. And I think fundamentally, you know, that is going to be, you know, those areas where social work is going to have to grapple with, and that there's going to be people that are going to take the examination, like I said, despite the examination results and biases and all that. And there are going to be people that will choose to have an option. I think both things can exist at the same time.
And how do you see all of this affecting this big push to make sure that the salaries become more equitable? How does that tie into the exam and, you know, all the compact? Because that's, you know, at the end of the day, you know, like social workers are, you know, always saying, like, you know, you got to pay us what we're worth because, you know, we have a profound impact on the lives of those we serve.
Yeah. And so it's interesting, right? And, you know, people have asked me that same question, you know, is this going to water down the profession? What does that mean for reimbursement rates and all the different things? And the reality of the situation is, and this is why we move to that idea of options, right? So it's both and. I think it's going to give us access to having more people in the workforce. And I think that, you know, it's also going to allow people to practice and work while they work towards that examination, right? And so one of the things that has come up, especially with individuals that have taken the examination quite a few times, is that they can't afford to continue to take the examination because they're already not practicing as a social worker. And so what does that look like for them to be able to now access the workforce, be able to, you know, work as a social worker while working towards that examination, right? And so this gives just more options than that. I think the other part of it too, and, you know, we'll just have to wait and see what that looks like, because the reality of the situation is, and again, right, being somebody who has held various positions in social work, nobody that I could ever recall has asked me on a job interview if I pass the examination. When I go out and get credentialed with insurance companies, they don't say, oh, send me your test scores. What they care about is, are you licensed in your state? And again, that licensing process is not the responsibility of managed care. It is not the responsibility of people outside of that. It is the responsibility of that state body that has been charged with licensing social workers. And so if you are licensed through that licensing process, then your license should be valid wherever it is accepted, right? And so that means that we're not going to create different rules, and we should advocate against when that if that comes up. And so again, thinking about the pay of social workers and that this is going to harm it, you know, if you think about it, especially in the context where this really has impact, and that's around providing therapy and services, right? Social work hasn't had a raise since 1988, 1989. The Medicaid rates the percentage of the fee scale that we get paid has been at 75% since that time. We are now currently working on legislation, the Improving Access to Mental Health Care Act, which is going to increase that rate from 75 to 85%, which will be the first time the social work profession has had a raise through CMS when it comes to providing services. And so, you know, this whole idea around will this harm the earning potential, I think is just a false flag. And I think at the end of the day, what we need to have a real conversation about is how do we get social workers to advocate for higher pay at both that individual level, but also at that organizational level, right? And so one of the things that I talk about a lot as we're talking about empowering social workers this month and anytime after this month is really this idea of go where you are appreciated and respected. And so if your job is not paying you a fair wage and, you know, you're in a space where you're unhappy, there's not a good work-life balance, then go where you are appreciated, where people are appreciating the work that you do. And those organizations will have to deal with the workforce not coming there or all that comes with that. At the same time, we are also participating in the social work census with a lot of our social work organizations and what that will do. This is the first of a large scale national survey of social workers by social workers to really get a better understanding of the workforce. And so understanding where people are working, understanding what they're doing, how much they're getting paid, what is their current education. And we're defining that, right? And so right now, if you were to look up how much does a social worker get paid, the first thing that'll probably pop up is that statistic from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It says that a fully independent licensed social worker should be making somewhere between $55,000 and $57,000 a year. That is, there's no other way to put it. That's false, right? And so when we do our own data, when we collect our own data and we put this information out there, it is meant to empower social workers and to provide them with tools so that they can start advocating and negotiating for their own salary. I think fundamentally, when we talk about social work salaries, we also have to couch that in a conversation about ensuring that we teach the profession also how to negotiate for their salaries. And so that is a different training. I can't say that in my master's program or any of my classes, was there ever a class that said, here's how you negotiate for your salary. Here's business 101. Here's how you think about finances, right? And so now we're getting more and more in those spaces. But I do think that fundamentally, because of the way that we are trained, right? Social work is a noble profession. I still remember when I was in my master's program, they used to have this saying, social workers do it for the outcome, not the income. And I always thought that was the weirdest statement ever, right? Because I'm like, wait, what? No, I actually care about the income, right? Because that's how I make a living and that's how I'm able to continue to do this work. And so I think that, you know, our training also has to start shifting the mindset that social workers can have a good salary. Social workers can also have a work-life balance, and social workers can have manageable caseloads when we start to advocate for ourselves.
Absolutely. And, you know, speaking about that phrase, a couple of years ago, I understand it was changed. And now it says we're in it for the outcome and the income.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, I tell people all the time, like, there's absolutely nothing wrong with social workers advocating for themselves, celebrating ourselves, celebrating the work that we do and advocating for higher pay. People, you know, sometimes people get a little squeamish because they're like, oh, that's not really the nobleness of our profession. And I'm like, says who?
That's right. That's right.
Like, absolutely. Who said that?
Where is that written, right?
Right.
So Dr. Eastreet, on Saturday, April 27th, this year, 2024, You will be the keynote speaker and a panelist at Adelphi University School of Social Work for the third annual Black Men's Mental Health and Wellness Conference. Tell the audience a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm super excited to be attending. I wasn't able to attend last year, but I said I wasn't going to miss it this year. So I am super excited to be attending it. I'm super excited to be, you know, the keynote and also on a panel and really just a space where we can talk about Black men's mental health. I think that is a topic that has always been there. So I let me say that. Black men and mental health issues have always been there. I think more recently, we've started to become much more comfortable with it, right? And so COVID was a huge moment where people started to realize that there was a lot more mental health issues out there than what people actually care to admit, right? I think the other part of it too, it allowed for Black men to really just check on each other, right? I remember the movement, You Good Man, right? And so it was really just asking the question to other Black men, like, are you good? And that's not a question that we ask a lot. And even if we do ask it, we give an answer, yeah, I'm good, I'm fine, right? And what does that really mean? And so this gives us an opportunity to really center the importance of Black men, mental health, and being able to address those issues so that we can live healthy, happy, and full lives, right? And so when we think about, you know, all the things that, you know, we have to deal with in our day-to-day as Black men, and really just, you know, having an outlet to express that, you know, we then think about the importance of therapy, the importance of connecting with other Black men, the importance of really just embracing that time to really talk to other Black men about things that are impacting the community, the family, and each of us, right? And so, you know, I know growing up, you know, one of the things that especially it was real big in the Black community, and it still shows up this day, is the stigma about mental health and really not talking about what's happening in the family, right? You know, what happens in this house stays in this house, or, you know, just get over it, right? You know, you're strong enough, like, stop crying about it, right? And so I think that this conference allows for, and it sets a beautiful stage for normalizing Black men that are seeking treatment, Black men that are curious about mental health treatment, Black men that are curious about connecting and fellowshipping with other Black men, without these labels that society have put on us about what it means to be vulnerable as a man, what it means to have feelings, and to show your kids that it's okay to have feelings, to what it means to be a husband and address those things that have been bothering you so you can have a healthy marriage. And so for me, it really does open up some opportunities for some powerful and empowering conversations that just have not necessarily made its way into the Black community until recently, but even more so within the Black men's space. And so I'm super excited to share in this space. Like I said, it'll be my first time attending it. I wasn't able to attend it last year because I was all of 3 months into this new role, and I was still trying to get my wits about me in this role, right?
Yes.
And so
yes,
being able to connect, being able to be a keynote, I was super excited about that. And really just the space that we are creating for other Black men to come and share in and learn about how do we address these things and really deal with this thing called life. You only got one life to live, so we might as well do it the best way we can. And why do you want to go through life miserable, sad, depressed, having all this anxiety when we can really engage and fellowship and talk about these things to figure out how to do life better and on our terms and be happy about it?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that I wanted to pose is how, in your opinion, is NASW addressing the pronounced need for in the Black and brown communities for men to seek out treatment that they need without shame? What is NASW doing to address that?
Yeah. And so, you know, it really does go back into this whole idea of creating space. One of the things that I would say is that, you know, social workers are the largest providers of behavioral health. And so we do have the largest workforce that are well equipped to work with Black men in mental health, Black and brown men in mental health, and really address their issues. One of the things that we have been really thinking about and really talking to our NCORID, our National Committee on Racial and Ethnic Disparities, is really, you know, how do we create this framework or support a framework that connects and links Black men to other therapists nationwide? So I have been looking at other attempts at that and other organizations that have been doing that to try to figure out what that support will look like, right? And so for me, I am very much a person that doesn't believe that NASW has to do all the things, but I do think that we can create some partnerships and coalitions to help that along. I am actually heading to the NABSW conference next week to really connect with and learn more about who's doing what in the community, right? Because I think the other part of it too is we have not been intentional about how do we get this wealth of resources into one space where we can figure it out and give people options, right? And so, you know, I don't want to say, oh, come visit Dr. Street. He works with Black men, because Dr. Street may not be your cup of tea. You may have to do four or five different iterations of a Black male therapist or a therapist in general before you find that right fit, right? And so we want to give people options. And so really thinking about how can we create connections and coalitions with some organizations that are really doing some good work out there.
Very good. Very well said. And as we get ready to wrap up, I like to always ask my guests to leave our audience with some inspiring words of wisdom. And in this instance, since we're billboarding the upcoming Black Men's Mental Health and Wellness Conference, leave us some inspiring words of wisdom regarding this conference and why it's needed and what people can expect.
You know, I think, well, one, it's definitely needed, right? And I think that one of the things that people can expect is some good old fashioned fellowship, right? And so that is a starting place, right? And sometimes it is just a conversation, whether that conversation leads to you actually seeking treatment or connecting with a provider, or that conversation gets you start thinking about some behaviors or some things you want to change in your life. I think that is a powerful opportunity, right? That's a powerful catalyst for change. And so again, I'm super excited about what this can be, because at the end of the day, we're going to create a network of men that have come together to address mental health. And if you only leave there with just a burning desire to find out more, then that is perfectly okay, because that means you're going to go do that research to find out how to access this change you're looking about. And you're going to leave there with other connections. Like I fundamentally believe that, you know, this will be a space where people will be open to connections. And so if you go into this space and you're not able to connect with people, I'm giving you full permission to come find me and connect with me. I am a person that loves to connect with other people. And I think it's fundamentally important to create these connections, because what I may not know, I may be able to rely on you. What you may not know, you may be able to ask and rely on somebody else. And so it's one of those situations where each one can teach one, and we can all grow our network in this beautiful space.
Awesome. Very well said. We're going to leave it right there. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's been my distinct pleasure to have this enlightening and in-depth conversation with Dr. Anthony E. Street. Again, he's the new Chief Executive Officer of the National Association of Social Workers. So grateful that you graced our show with your presence, Dr. E. Street. Thank you so much. And we look forward to seeing you on April 27th at the Black Men's Mental Health and Wellness Conference. Make sure everybody come out if you haven't registered yet. Please go online and do so. It's going to be great. This will be my third year attending. I was actually a panelist for the inaugural one, and I'm sure it's going to be a really, really special time, especially with you there, Dr. E. Street. So, ladies and gentlemen, on that note, I'm going to say thank you, Dr. E. Street, for joining us today on the Kelso on the Air Social Work Podcast. Thank you, and we all appreciate all your time and your efforts. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. I was happy to be here. It's been great.
Once again, this is Silas, your e-journalism social work advocate, producer, and host of the show. You've been listening to the award-winning Kelson on the Air Social Work Podcast. This and all other episodes are available on our Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, and iHeart audio podcast platforms, among others. The podcast is also available on our Spotify and YouTube video podcast platforms. Go to any search engine and type in Kelson on the Air in the search window to hear this show in its entirety. Please make sure to click subscribe to support our podcast. And don't forget to like, comment, download, and share. To reach us for more information, email us at info@kelson.org. That's info@kelson.org. Or to suggest future topics, log into www.kelson.org. That's www.kelson.org, and fill out the Share a Topic form on our homepage. Thank you for tuning in. This has been a Kelson Communications production.